Welcome to this RCGP podcast on the holistic care for patients with inflammatory bowel disease. I'm Dr. Tony Hazel, GP and Deputy Medical Director for e-learning at the RCGP. Today I'll be talking to Dr. Kevin Barrett. Kevin is a GP in Watford with a long-standing interest in inflammatory bowel disease. He's a past chair and current committee member for the Primary Care Society for Gastroenterology and was clinical champion for the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Spotlight Project, supported by the RCGP and Crohn's and Colitis UK. Thank you for joining us today, Kevin.
Thank you, Tony.
So let's start at the beginning with the diagnosis of inflammatory bowel disease or IBD. How can we, in practice, increase our chances of picking up IBD early rather than patients waiting some time from first presentation to diagnosis?
I think there's a holistic approach to this. We are trying to encourage our patients and the public to talk about their poo in a variety of different ways through all sorts of different things, campaigns on social media, the campaigns that Crohn's Colitis UK are doing, all sorts of things. We're trying to break the poo taboo to get people not to be afraid or embarrassed to talk about their changes in bowel habits. That's the first thing. I think also that we're trying to make sure that GPs are aware of the possibility that inflammatory bowel disease exists, and we're not just and that every patient that presents with lower GI symptoms, obviously it's important to think about colorectal cancer. That's always an important diagnosis to exclude. But to think about IBD as well as IBS as well. So just always have that in the back of my mind. Could this be IBD in this patient? We do often think about IBD as being particularly a condition affecting adults or young adults at least, but it can affect anyone of any age. It can present in childhood, so general symptoms, failure to thrive, they can be particularly present more than the bowel symptoms in children. And children sometimes have a slightly more aggressive, slightly different course to adults because they're more likely to have a single gene defect than perhaps the adult population will do as well. There's classic symptoms, abdominal pain, change in bowel habit, weight loss, blood in the stool, all those sorts of things are things that make us think about colorectal cancer. But again, just think about IBD, particularly in the younger population. Although, as we said before, IBD can affect anyone of any age from infancy through to those approaching 100 years old as well. The IBD toolkit that Crohn's Colitis UK produced, and we've got the new campaign that the Crohn's Colitis UK are producing called Cut the Crap. So we follow that. Patients come to us and we use our knowledge and the pathways that are present for us. Then I think we can improve the diagnosis and improve the time it takes to get patients diagnosed. And there is evidence around that the quicker patients get diagnosed, then actually the more likely that they are to respond positively to treatments and are less likely to progress to more severe disease with it. So, yeah, a multifaceted approach to things.
Absolutely. There's always lots of different ways we can address this. And I agree, getting patients just not to be embarrassed about talking about their bowels is really important. So if I've got a patient in front of me and I'm thinking about IBD, then clearly I might do a full blood count and I might do inflammatory markers. But we also have newer tests available. And I think we're both of a similar vintage such that these tests didn't exist when we qualified from medical school. Can you explain a bit about the fecal immunochemical test, otherwise known as FIT, and about fecal calprotectin?
Yeah, absolutely. And as you said, Tony, these tests weren't around. We had to rely upon history for blood counts and inflammatory markers, and they are still really important tests to be done, and we shouldn't forget about doing those. If we do those tests and they show that patients are anemic with raised inflammatory white cell counts and CRPs and ESRs, then absolutely that's often all we need to do. We don't need to do those more fancy tests or the later tests that are around. FIT testing, there's lots been written about FIT testing at the moment because it's often an obligatory thing that we have to do if we're referring somebody for a lower GI referral. It looks for human blood and actually therefore can pick up inflammatory bowel disease. So again, if that is positive and the patient meets the two-week wait referral pathway, the suspected cancer referral pathways, then we should use those. But again, almost any patient that has unexplained rectal bleeding needs some kind of investigation, not necessarily an urgent one, but they certainly need something to be done and looked at as well. And that's how often patients with things like ulcerative colitis in particular get picked up. Calprotectin has been around for a while. Around about 2016, 2018 is when it became widely available through most of the UK. I think there are still a few areas where it's not available. And then during the COVID times, occasionally the labs stopped making it available because they had to use some of the reagents to do the COVID test. However, It is mostly available in almost every single part of the UK, with a few small exceptions to that. So calprotectin is a calcium binding protein that's released from neutrophils in the presence of inflammation. So it's a very sensitive test for looking for that. And if you get a negative test, it's fairly reassuring that actually there isn't inflammation present in the lower bowel, and therefore the patient's unlikely to have inflammatory bowel disease. FIT and calprotectin, they're not diagnostic tests. They're tests that are used for screening. So again, if those, that little spidey sense is going off in the back of your head, think actually there's something not quite with this patient, and they've got a negative FIT or negative calprotectin, we should have a discussion with somebody about making a potential referral to think about something else that could be going on. So calprotectin, again, as it's released in the presence of inflammation, you can get false positive results, or at least not false positive, about you can get inappropriately raised tests. So gastroenteritis in particular, that will put up a calprotectin test. So that's where we need to think about not using it immediately and somebody presents with a 1 or 2 week history of a change in bowel habit. The consensus is 4 to 6 weeks at least of consistent change in bowel habits with negative inflammatory markers and a normal full blood count. That's the general time you should do a calprotectin test, just to make sure you're not picking up a patient and sending them off for investigations that have often, and their conditions often settle down by the time we get those done. Calprotectin, again, it can be useful to monitor flares and response to treatments. There's a good correlation between calprotectin levels and mucosal healing, generally used in secondary care, though, so we don't often get asked to do that in primary care. And often calprotectin, the age is limited in primary care to the younger patients, again, because of that potential overlap with colorectal cancer. So you might get asked to do it in primary care, and if you do, it's worth doing because it can help when we're looking at flares. But it's predominantly used to suspect inflammatory bowel disease in patients presenting for the first time with new lower GI symptoms.
That's a really useful summary. It's so important to relate the patient in front of you and the test, whether they come back positive or negative. So another issue that I find difficult is management of flares. Now, in an ideal world, of course, we'd all have swift access to secondary care advice, to the IBD team, and sometimes that does happen, but not always. If you've got a patient who's really unwell, septic, dehydrated, that's easy. They're going in. But what advice have you got for someone whose symptoms aren't quite so bad and you wonder if you can manage them at home?
Yeah, this is very difficult. Again, patients can deteriorate and their flares can come on really rapidly. And they're often the easiest to diagnose because they say to you, you know, a month, 6 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, I felt absolutely fine. My symptoms fit those that I normally get when I have a flare and I'm going downhill. The issue we get sometimes is that the onset can be more insidious. So patients will kind of just gradually get a change, deterioration. Or we go to the toilet more often, passing maybe a little bit of blood, a little bit of lower abdominal pain, sometimes cramping pains. And they put up with it because they tolerate it. They don't realize that they're actually going to the toilet more often. And those patients that progress over a few weeks or a few months, they can actually become really unwell, but they compensate quite happily, both physiologically and also mentally. So they get used to it. And you say to them, actually, I'm really worried about you. You know, you look really poorly. You've got a slight temperature. Your blood pressure's low. I think you need to go into hospital. And they'll often say, no, I don't need to. I felt like this for several weeks. I don't need to go in. Those are the ones that can be really tricky to manage. But in terms of the ones that you come up with a fairly obvious flare, the idea is that every single patient eventually should have a patient held care plan. So that secondary care teams will tell us exactly what disease they've got, which bit of the bowel it affects, and what to do in case they have a flare. Now, if they have that, that's fantastic. Again, only a minority of patients have those. If you do have an accessible IBD advice line, then you can use that one. Crohn's and Colitis UK have got an IBD nurse map on there, so you can put in your postcode, whether you're working regularly or working as a locum somewhere, and it will tell you the contact details and the response times for the IBD advice lines across all of England and most of UK as well. So have a look for that. It's easy to find online. We also got the flare pathways. So those are available on the IBD toolkit. We'll have links to the flare pathways on that have been approved by the RCGP and the PCSG and the British Society of Gastroenterology. And they are predominantly aimed at patients with ulcerative colitis. And they tell us what to do, when to suspect a flare, what investigations to do to check inflammatory markers, calprotectin possibly if that's available, and then what to do with the treatments. Lots of people end up on steroids. And again, steroids absolutely can be the right thing for patients. But what we mustn't do is give steroids unnecessarily or give lots of very short course of steroids. The flare pathways are useful because they tell us when to increase their other medications. So their 5-ASA medication, for example, and make sure that you've maximized the rectal therapy and the oral therapy of those. And then before you move on to the steroids. Steroids, again, usually typically need a long course of steroids, sort of 8-ish weeks of steroids to make sure the patient is responding and that the flare is properly treated. Lots of debate going on about the benefits of prednisolone versus budesonide. Prednisolone generally is more effective. Budesonide comes as forms that are released according to the preparation in different parts of the bowel. So again, there's a place for those in particular patient groups. And we have to always check the licensing and the indication, and often prescribed by brand rather than generic prescribing for budesonide within that. Not quite as effective on the whole as prednisolone. However, it has a place, a lot more expensive. And we know that, particularly in COVID times, that budesonide was preferred because it doesn't tend to have that systemic immunosuppressive reaction that prednisolone can be, that can have as well. So just a few quick pointers there about that. I think the key with patients having flares, it's actually really important to let the IBD team know that the patient's having a flare, especially if you end up giving them steroids, oral steroids. Because there's lots of evidence that if patients having a couple of flares per year, if they can't wean off the oral steroids and get below a certain level, or they have a flare pretty quickly within about 6 weeks of stopping the steroids, that actually their long-term disease-modifying treatments need to be reviewed and looked at, and they might need to have those escalated or changed or something else being done. And it's very easy for patients to forget that they've had a course of steroids when they go for their theoretical annual review with the secondary care team. So it's always important for us to drop them a line, often a quick email or a letter, or we can ask the patients to do it themselves. Actually, sometimes that's often an easy way to do it, just reduce the admin burden on us. Communication with secondary care is definitely an important thing that we need to be doing as GPs.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it's often easier these days when we have direct email addresses. And some of those resources sound fantastic. I wasn't aware of them, so I will make sure I have access to them now. And so finally, as GPs, obviously, we have a holistic role. We look after every aspect of a patient's life. What does that look like for a patient with IBD?
Yeah, certainly GPs do have a role in looking after and supporting our patients with IBD. So we think that those patients, particularly with complex disease, that we don't need to really worry about them because they're being looked after by the secondary or tertiary care teams. And that is certainly true for lots of patients on biologic medications, complex regimes, all sorts of things. Generally, though, the secondary care teams, they don't have the time or the staffing to think about the wider aspects of the patient's life. So things like contraception, that's something often things that patients will come to us about as GPs. As I said before, we should know which bit of the bowel the patient's disease affects. Patients with rapid bowel transit times or small bowel disease that might have problems with absorption, they're the ones that we need to be really careful of when using oral contraceptives. So oral contraception is a UK MEC2 in that group. So it may not be appropriate for that patient. They might be better off having an implant or an intrauterine device or something like that rather than having oral contraception in that situation as well. Cradle to grave approach, really important for us as GPs. So as I said before, IBD can affect anyone of any age. And once you've got it, then it becomes a long-term condition, can have the health costs the same as having diabetes, for example. Different life stages affect people. Lots of people are diagnosed with IBD when they're teenagers in the early 20s, when they're moving around doing exams, leaving education, moving on to university, moving on to start jobs and families and things, often moving around, physically moving around, so they can get lost to follow up to secondary care. So again, we have a role within that just to make sure that they do have that support, they are plugged into the right bits of the system with it too. Pregnancy again, really important thing. So preconception planning is vital. So obviously it's much better to have a planned pregnancy in a patient with IBD. Medication, almost every medication that patients are on, with the exception of methotrexate in women and some of the biologics, are actually safe in pregnancy. And the evidence is much better for patients to be taking those medications, continue taking them, because the risk of them coming off and having a flare, you get much worse outcomes for the baby and the mother if they have a flare during pregnancy. So actually trying to get patients to continue on that medication. It's worth seeking advice from the IBD team, just to actually make sure the pregnancy is planned, that they're taking the right level of folic acid. We've had all the vaccinations, all the bits and pieces as well. So definitely make sure that we communicate with patients when they come to us thinking, I want to start a family. I'm going to talk about the cost of living and the NHS crisis at the moment as well. It's very difficult sometimes with people knowing how to access healthcare, financial struggles with prescription costs. They can be a real struggle for lots of young people these days and older people as well. Most primary care networks in England and similar offers around the rest of the UK have access to social prescribers. If not, then we've got access to Citizens Advice Bureau. So we can point them towards that to make sure they actually have the right sort of benefits and financial support that can happen as well. And also sometimes liaising with employers can be important. I know we're not occupational health physicians, but sometimes we get asked for our input into those sorts of situations as well. So just have a think about the holistic approach to those patients, which I absolutely know we do as GPs all the time. Vaccinations, again, really important. So we have all of those in primary care. So COVID in particular, lots been written on those groups, those at-risk groups for COVID vaccinations and COVID boosters. And the Green Book is very clear in chapter 14A about which groups are valid. I know during COVID times things changed on a weekly basis about that. That reference book is really useful, the tables in there about who's eligible. And we mustn't forget about flu and pneumonia vaccinations as well in primary care. Disease-modifying drugs, again, we don't generally get involved in prescribing biologics in primary care. But lots of patients on drugs like azathioprine, sometimes on methotrexate, those on 5-ASAs, they do need to have regular drug monitoring done just to make sure the kidneys and liver and things, depending which drug they're on, is monitored as well. So there are often shared care protocols for those. It is also important when patients prescribe medication in secondary care, so the biologics, that actually we do add those to the hospital issued part of our clinical assistants, because that actually helps us pick up when those patients are eligible for certain things, for example, with COVID vaccinations, or if they're kind of interactions with live vaccinations. And the typical ones for that are things like yellow fever for travel, the nasal flu, those vaccinations as well. So it's definitely worth adding those on an issue, and there was a hospital issue prescription, so at least they get picked up when you do the interactions on there as well. Live vaccines, again, shingles vaccines, again, doesn't particularly affect the younger population, but we do have patients over 70 with IBD, and we do the occasional one who's at risk. There is a non-live version of the shingles vaccine that's available, so we do make sure they have those, if particularly they're immunosuppressed with a disease-modifying drug or biologic. So again, that's another reason to make sure we add that to our prescribing screen, to pick those up just in case we have a patient with that as well. Another couple of things, again, it's really important for us, is don't forget mental health. Lots of evidence around the patient with inflammatory bowel disease, partly because of the physiological effects that the disease has. Again, with any chronic inflammatory condition, we get the cytokines and other bits and pieces that pass in the blood-brain barrier and have a neurochemical effect on the brain functioning. So as well as the psychological impact of being diagnosed with a long-term relapsing remitting condition with no known cure. Don't forget to use CBT, improving access psychological therapies, treatments that we have available. And there's lots of evidence around that telephone-based CBT is actually as effective as face-to-face CBT, and that was true before the COVID pandemic as well. And I think finally, we mustn't forget about diet and dietitians. So again, they have a role to play. Lots of people with IBD restrict their diet, but greater risk of malnutrition through increased bowel transit times or small bowel disease. So things like iron and vitamin D, they can all be deficient in those quite rapidly, and that can contribute to the fatigue. If you have the luxury of a dietitian, a service available, then use those and make sure patients get that advice Again, I know it's not available everywhere, but if you have it, then it's definitely worth using. If you don't have one, then I'll push for that. So I think there's a role for GPs in all sorts of aspects of IBD management, as well as us liaising with our secondary and tertiary care teams.
That's fantastic, Kevin. Thank you so much. Such a broad range of things we need to be thinking about. And I think it's so easy to just concentrate on the physical aspects and forget the mental health and psychological aspects of a chronic disease. So I think that's all we've got time for today. And I'd like to say a big thank you to Dr. Kevin Barrett for joining us to discuss holistic aspects of inflammatory bowel disease. Thank you very much for listening. And if you enjoyed this RCGP podcast, then please have a look at the e-learning website to find others on a variety of subjects. Thank you and goodbye.
Thank you.